Welcome to episode 19 of the James Murua Literary Podcast. I'll be your host, James Murua, and our guest will be Abubakar Adam Ibrahim. Abubakar is a writer of The Whispering Trees and Seasons of Crimson Blossoms. The latter book got him the Nigerian Prize for Literature, which is the richest in African letters. On our podcast, we'll be chatting about his newest book, a short story collection called Dreams and Assorted Nightmares, based around the mythical Zango area. Apart from the book, we'll be chatting about writing and publishing across the continent and in Nigeria in general. And we'll be checking in on him to find out what's happening in Nigeria after the NSARS protest that we all heard about in the recent past. I hope you've enjoyed part one of the discussion, and if you are here now, it means you clearly must have. We are now on to part two. Let's do this. Ladies and gentlemen, Abubakar Adam Ibrahim, enjoy.
I was trying to say, the social commentary you're bringing in this collection is really, really on point. You're bringing in issues which are not part of the list. I think you were in an interview, you mentioned that. HIV, FGM.
Stuff like that.
I have to say, you really were disappointing. Where that list is concerned, you were very disappointing. You didn't deliver on it.
What you did deliver on
was, I was really, really excited when I saw this issue, the story with the mental health, this young whose son died. And the thing is, I know that mental health is a real issue across the continent. It's a big deal. I mean, here in Kenya, we have so many people and so very few mental health professionals. And please bring us into why it was so important for you to do this specific story.
I think it's important because increasingly, I think we're becoming aware of the severity of mental health cases that we have on the continent. This is something that has always been there anyway, but it's something that has always been treated with shame, right? You have someone who is mentally ill or mentally challenged, and the solution is to hide that person and pretend they don't exist. And I think I mentioned this in that interview, I think it was the IK interview, right? In a place like Kano, for instance, you have, I don't know, maybe hundreds, maybe dozens of people who are having mental issues, and their families decide to just put them in a room and chain them. And some of them have been locked in a room for 30 years. I mean, like, 30 years, you put one person in a room, and you lock him up.
30 years?
Absolutely. I'm not exaggerating. 30 years, 30.
Oh.
Yeah, there are people who have been locked up that long because they have mental issues and their families don't know what to do with them. So I was trying to kind of, understand the dilemma of both the family and the people with the mental health challenges, and the fact that, you have this person, and in the case of this woman, she loves her son. She absolutely loves him. But he's not fit for society, right? So what does she do with him? There's no space for people like him in the society. We don't accommodate them. As a journalist, I worked on a story where we had just for World Mental Health Day, and we took stock of all the mental health facilities we have in the country and all of that. And they are horrible, horrible spaces. I mean, they are really, really terrible spaces. You go there and you see people chained to trees like wild animals, and you have people who are not actually professionals, you know, looking after them because the professionals are not there, right? So maybe you don't have enough psychiatrists or psychologists or whoever is needed to take care of their mental health issues. So you have nurses instead, you know, or you have people who have just graduated from public health schools or something who are not really mental health professionals, right? But they just find a job in that area and they do that. So you have a lot of issues like that. Could you believe that for a country the size of Nigeria with 200 million people, we have just about, I think, between 200 and 600 mental health experts in the country. Like trained psychiatrists who can attend to mental health cases. Just about 200 or 600, I'm trying to remember the exact figure. For 200 million people. So how do you explain that, right? How do you explain, how does that work?
How? I mean, Lagos has what, 200, Lagos has 20 million people, 20 something million people.
Yeah, Lagos alone, right? And I consider the rest of the country, consider how big it is, and all of that. So you understand that these people are even overwhelmed in the first place, and then you consider that they are poorly paid, right? And you have all these factors that the facilities are simply not there for them to work. So a lot of them end up leaving the country to go and work elsewhere where their services would be appreciated and all of that. So you have a lot of people here in Nigeria who don't have access to this medical, the medication that they need. They don't have access to the experts that they need. So they are left with a dilemma. Do I just commit my beloved who has mental issues to a space where he'll be treated like an animal chained to a tree and fed like a dog more or less, or do I do this myself and take care of them in the best way that I can? You know, and this is the dilemma I wanted to talk about with that story. Like, what does this woman do with this son that she loves and wants to protect? Yeah.
That story actually, like, it really touched me, man. I was there. That's one of the stories which really affected me, because the quality of the life of both the child and them, the quality of the life was not. No, no, but you know, you're supposed to be. That's why we read these books. That's why we read these stories. Yeah. Because they're supposed to make us think. I mean, talking about thinking, you know, like I was reading this story, Saja, with the car. And initially, when I started reading this story, I thought it was, it initially started to look like it would be one of those, Stephen King has a famous novel called Christine, where he introduces a car which has a demon within. And initially, when I was reading this story, I was like, okay, this is a bit Stephen King-y. Then it turned out that it's just a discussion about how residents of this city and a lot of us across the continent deal with a simple thing as a car. You know, for others it's a big deal, but for most of the majority of the population, a car is such a valuable asset.
I think there are enough demons in Zango that I didn't need to put one in a car, you know. that would have been too much. But yeah, you know, Saja is a story I love very much, because it embodies the aspiration of people. And for different people, these aspirations take different forms, right? And for this particular character, you know, I mean, he has a family, he has a business that is, you know, but he's struggling. And his greatest aspiration in life is to own this car, right? And he does, and he shows us all his love and affection on it, and he becomes... He is obsessed with this car, right?
Yes. Even
to the detriment of his own family. And they couldn't understand it. And they're like, what? It's just a bloody car. But for him, it was far more than that. It's something, it's sort of like the, how do you put it? sort of like the icing on the cake, right? Or maybe something more significant than that. It's like the thing that makes his life complete, in the sense that he's achieved his greatest goal in life, and the fact that it took him even that long to get to that point for him was a tragedy, right, of monumental proportions. So it's about that. It's about the aspiration that people have and what defines that aspiration and how they relate to it when they eventually get there. You know, like someone said, the success is not just getting to the top, but staying there. And for him, that's, he's got to the top, but staying there was proven to be very challenging. You know, and it was exploring that challenge of keeping this thing that he loves so much, even against the other things that he actually loves more, as he later realized. You know, so it's about that. It's about sacrifices that people have to make when they need to make them.
If you're talking about monsters, I mean, there are monsters. I mean, I really did not expect this, because I thought it was just a nice story, a short story collection with, you know, relationships and marriages. And then suddenly we get a story called Melancholia, where Captain is a crazy young woman, and suddenly we are dealing with the actual monsters. Okay.
Was that a monster, James?
How do you get to this? Because I mean, listen, we know you for your wonderful stories in The Whispering Tree. Then, you know, for Reza, who you will always be asked questions about, I'm sure. And then now suddenly you have this woman who kills herself and starts harassing this couple.
Yeah. It's she's obsessed. And maybe she might have been mentally challenged as well. Maybe she might have had mental issues. You know. No, not maybe. She definitely did, right? You know. But also, it's also this exploration of obsession with things, with people, and wanting to be in people's lives even when they don't have space for you. And in our own case, you know, there was no space. There simply wasn't any. And Captain wasn't willing to make one for her. I mean, he has a wife, he has a family, he was very happy with his wife. Even though their marriage wasn't particularly ideal, but what marriage is, right? But then he was determined to stick with his wife, because she stuck with him as well. And then you have this woman who wants something else. And then she becomes something different, and presents a different kind of challenge. And for me, the fact is that the most interesting bit about the story is how are they going to live with this thing, right? And the efforts that they make to hide these things from each other. I mean, the wife knew what was going on initially, but then she wanted to, because she loved her husband so much, she wanted to protect him from him, more or less, right? And he too wanted to protect her from her. So it's this, I don't know, this counter attraction between their desire to protect each other from each other, right, or from themselves. That was the most fascinating bit for me. Yeah.
So in this story, in that story, the couple is doing everything they can to come together and stay together, in spite of, you know, the messes and what. But and then in a very brief marriage, it's a little bit different. We have okay. Is this how, like, when the bandits come to your house in that part of the country? Is that how they come? They knock and ask you to open? You know.
No. I mean, Aldo Kore is a peculiar kind of bandit. He's different. He's confident in his banditry. He's even arrogant at it, right? You know, he's the kind of person that has the guts to come to your door and knock and say, "Oh, you know, it's a guest. You know, open the door. I'm coming." Either way. And you know, you would see his character develop further down the collection, you know. And you see that he plays an even more prominent role in the whole of Zengo than was projected in that brief marriage. I enjoyed writing his character a lot. I really did. I mean, it was fun. And I remember my publisher making this joke about, he said, you like writing bad bandits and bad guys. And you do it so well. You're a bandit writer.
I cannot bring this up. Like, one of the things about your, like, the way you write your stories, your characters are really well known, and especially your female characters. I mean, everybody writes women characters in their books because, you know, women are half of the population. But it's so interesting for me how you write them so well, and I normally see the response from many of the women readers who respond really positively, like you really are speaking to them. How do you do this? Because it's not a very easy skill. Not everybody can write women characters of any type. No, forget about, like, you know, whether they are from conservative society or whatever society. It's not as easy for men to write women characters as people should write. What is it that you're doing? What are you? I mean, these are women who are having sex. These are women who are, you know, they're sharing their issues with their bodies. Somebody else would be a bit scared to talk about this.
You want me to tell you how I write these women characters?
I'm really interested, man, because I've read a lot of books, and many of the writers that I encounter, there are things that they go to a certain point and then they stop. But you lay it all out so that, you know, you can see the whole picture.
Oh. Are you sure? I don't know what picture James has been looking at, so I don't know what he's talking about.
Yeah, but how do you form your win? Because this is something I want to know.
It's a great secret, James. I can't tell you that.
You can't tell me that. Because your women are not like, they're not good women, they're not bad women, they're just fully formed human beings.
They're women, that's what they are, right? I mean, they're like men in that sense, in the sense that, you know, they're not angels, they're not demons, they're not witches or wizards or something, they're just women. And that means that they are complicated, they are strong, they are beautiful, they are flawed, they are all these things rolled up into one. And they're wonderful and intriguing, and you know, that's who they are. That's what I try to capture. I think we make a lot of people make the mistake of saying, you know, I want to write women that are perfect, probably. And you try to force this idea of perfection on these characters, and no character is perfect, because no human is perfect, right? Everybody is flawed, everybody has weaknesses and strengths, and even the worst of us have their most outstanding qualities, and even the best of us have their own shortcomings, you know, and for me, you know, working all of these things into a character is one of the greatest curiosities that I like to explore. You know, how do you bring all of these things to work together in a character? And I like it when my characters ruffle people. You know, I mean, you can't just be too comfortable with them. Because no matter how much you like somebody, there's something about the person that annoys you. And even when you really don't like somebody, when you dislike somebody so much, if you just look at that person, observe that person, you discover something you actually like about the person, you know, and that's what humans are. That's what I try to capture when I write women and I write men, other people and other things and other creatures and other.
This book, where would you place it in a bookshop? I know you don't. This is not your job. Is this magical realism? Because there are so many different things.
Yeah. I don't know. It is what it is, right?
We call it Magical Daniel in parts of this country.
Yeah, maybe it's genre bending, or it's all different thing, or maybe it's something that I don't know. Of course, I've always been fascinated by magical realism. I love that a lot. But like I've always said, you know, I think there's also maybe a limit, right? Because there are instances where it goes overboard and it becomes something else, and you're like, okay, you know, this is not making sense anymore. You know, so yeah, I like playing on the verge of full-blown magical realism and being fully grounded in realism as well. I think that's very important because I think there are lots of important stories to tell about this continent, about the people who occupy this continent. And it would be a shame if all of that is lost in a fantastical cloud, right? Then people go, oh, it's just magical, it's fantastical, and all of that. And then they forget that there are actually real issues that affect real people that you're trying to talk about here. So yeah, it's always important to be grounded in magical realism, but in realism, and then to bring in that element of magical realism, because they exist. It's all around us. It's, you know, you see funny things, you hear funny things, you see people doing funny things because they believe in funny things, you know, and that's what it is, you know. So yeah, I'm happy it's not my job to classify this. So I let those whose job it is to do that.
This book collection can go into, you know, you can go for the Momo Awards, you can go for several different categories of different type of awards. By the way, I really love this cover. Who designed this cover? You know, when I saw the cover, I didn't get it. I had to finish the collection to know what the hell this cover was about.
Oh, okay.
About. Who did this cover?
Yeah. The cover designer is I don't know. I don't have his name here, but it's someone who works with Anderson. Anderson Oriahim. This is the book. And it's a wonderful cover, it's fantastic. Oh yeah. You know, and I like it a lot. Okay. And we had conversations about what the cover should be like, you know, went back and forth. And I love that process as well, because, you know, when you write a book, you often don't think about what the cover is going to look like. But I always like having, input in what the cover is going to look like. And I'm happy I had the chance to, you know, talk about this, and we did several iterations, and this one came through, and it was fantastic, and I love it, absolutely.
Are we expecting any translations of this book? Am I being too early? Because I've noticed that you've been having translations of your earlier work, and I suspect translations are very important for what you're doing.
Yeah, they are. I mean, it's important that. Even though we write about a specific space, right? My writing transcends, you know, that space, because inevitably I'm writing about humans, whether they are in Nigeria or somewhere else, you know, and it's that human experience that I want to tap into and connect with. And it's also important that people elsewhere read what you write and connect with it, even though the reality of the character's life is different from theirs, but they get to experience a connection of some kind. So, okay, Nick, thank you. I hope you enjoy it, and enjoy Berlin as well. Yeah. So.
Yes,
Yeah, Nick is going to read the book, so I hope he enjoys it. So I was saying about translations. We will see. We will see. We will see what happens. Yeah. Like I said, the process of... Yeah?
No, just go in the process of... Just finish your thought.
Yeah, I was just about to say that, you know, the process of bringing out this book is not... it's a bit strange, but we'll figure it out eventually and see how it happens.
When is the book available to the public, and where will they be able to buy it?
It's going to be available from November 30th. We've had to push back the publication date a couple of times. It was supposed to come out in July, and then COVID happened, so everything went into lockdown, which means that the production of the book had to, you know, suffer setbacks and all of that. So we moved the date to October, and then we had issues with shipments, and but finally I think November 30th is going to be the date. To pre-order, you can go to the Masobe website and pre-order there. And then for the rest of the continent, we'll see what happens as well.